right. Well, as we continue on with our study of what God expects of our families, I'll remind us of the verse that we are sort of using as a key verse, and that's Psalm 127 and 1. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. And so we've kind of made it through most of the family. You know, we've talked about husbands and wives and fathers and mothers and children. And so now we make it to, really we have three remaining topics that on the original outline I said we would cover. And those are, what does the Bible say about siblings? And then what to do with our family members who don't believe? And then sometimes our friends are like family. And so the last topic we'll address are friends. And so I think Tad finished for me last week talking about children. And so this week we're going to talk about siblings. And so I want to start by looking at Genesis, the fourth chapter. So let's go ahead and turn there. In Genesis, the fourth chapter, we have the very first question that man asks God. Now, God has asked man a couple of questions up until this point. In fact, if you look at the questions in the Bible, God has asked man, I think, about seven questions. And this, the first time that man questions God, I think, is about the eighth question. But if you recall here in Genesis chapter 4, this is really begins with the birth of Cain and Abel, our first two siblings that we have recorded in the Bible, first two siblings, period. And so what we know is that God asked for sacrifices. And when we go to Hebrews chapter 11, hold your finger here in Genesis 4. Let's go to Hebrews 11, because we know that Cain offered what? What was Cain's sacrifice? Yeah, it was offering of stuff he grew. And what was Abel's sacrifice?
An animal sacrifice.
So in Hebrews chapter 11, we get a little bit of information that we don't have way back in Genesis chapter 4. And let's see, what's the verse I'm looking for here?
Verse 4.
Clayton, you want to read that for us? All right. So here we have in the very beginning of this verse that we know that by faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice. Now, we couple this with some other verses like Romans, the 10th chapter and the 17th verse. What are we told in Romans 10, 17? Faith comes by
hearing.
All right. So, and hearing by the word of God. So we know that Abel, based on what we see here in Hebrews chapter 11, Abel must have been told, Cain as well, must have been told what to bring, because it's by faith, and faith comes through hearing. So Abel must have heard from God somehow what God expected of his sacrifice. And so Cain brings an offering of the ground, and Abel brings an offering from his flock. And God respected Abel's offering and Abel. And then in verse 5, it says, but he did not respect Cain or his offering, which sort of gives the idea that maybe Cain just wasn't listening anyway. So then we have what happens next. So I don't want to focus so much on the sacrifice, but I want to focus on what happens next. Cain was disappointed in himself. He was upset, angry at Abel. And so let's read verses 8 and 9. Someone read that for us.
Cain talked with Abel's brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?
All right. So here we have this question, this somewhat infamous question. So Cain has killed his brother Abel. God knows this. God comes and asks Cain, where's your brother? And Cain first lies, right? He first says, I don't know. And then he asks this question, Well, am I my brother's keeper? And, you know, it is the first question that man asked God, and sadly it's a question that is asked in a way to deflect from the reality of what has just happened. But I think this is a good question for us to ask. Are you your brother's keeper? Now, we can make spiritual application here, obviously, right? And much of what the Bible talks about when it talks about caring for your brethren, your brother, what it's dealing with is your spiritual family. But really, I want to focus in on your physical family. So, what does the Bible say about siblings? Well, frankly, not much. The Bible doesn't say a whole lot about siblings, but I think it's very interesting that just because the Bible doesn't make mention of siblings in a commandment kind of way, I don't think it makes it an insignificant topic. Think about the relationship that you have with your siblings. The relationship you have with your siblings is the longest term relationship you'll have with anyone in your family. Your parents will eventually, under normal situations, your parents will die before you die. And so your relationship with them will be, you know, maybe 50, 60 years. Your children, you will die before your children, most likely, and your relationship with them will be 50, 60 years maybe. But your relationship with your siblings is different, because you may have a relationship with your siblings that's 60, 70, 80 years. You see, as children, our siblings are our playmates, our companions, but also our bitter rivals, aren't they? Did you ever have a knockdown, dragout with your brother or your sister? I usually won. That's what I like to say. But as adults, what happens? Well, one of two things usually happens as adults. Either you become close friends, or your lives just intersect at key moments. Maybe at some family gathering. But what happens when you're old? When you're old, your relationship with your siblings changes again. If you weren't close friends, then you do become friends again under most normal circumstances. And that's because your siblings are the only link you have to your past life. Siblings who may have been adversaries during your childhood or some distant friends while you were raising your own families, those become a source of comfort in your old age. And you know, you think about the relationship that you have with your brothers and your sisters, it's very unique as it relates to the rest of your family, because the rest of your family, you have intergenerational issues, right? Your parents are older than you. Your children are younger than you. And sometimes, because of that age difference, you don't relate well with each other. Yet, with your siblings, you're of the same generation. And so, there's a lot of similarities. In most cases, our siblings are not just our loved ones, but also our peers. And that gives us an interesting ability to understand them and relate to their problems in a way that's different from the way that we relate to the problems of our parents or relate to the problems of our children. And I think the Bible points this out to us. So let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 5. Your sibling is your peer. And because of that, you have a different kind of relationship with that person than you would with your parents or your children, just because they're the same age as you. So here in 1 Timothy chapter 5, we're going to look at verses 1 and 2. And here, Paul is giving Timothy, who is a relatively young man, instructions on how to deal with other people. So someone read 1 Timothy 5, 1 and 2 for us.
Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, with all purity.
Now, isn't this interesting here? I find it interesting. I find it interesting that Paul here commands Timothy to rebuke an individual. So when somebody needs correction, Timothy, as an evangelist, he was going to run into those situations where he was going to have to correct people. And Paul gives him some wisdom here. He says, when you have to rebuke someone who is older, treat them like you would treat your father. But people who are your own age, treat them like they're your brother or your sister. And just in that statement, it distinguishes that you have a different kind of relationship with people your own age, people who are your brothers and sisters. I talk to my brothers much differently than I talk to my parents. Have you ever talked to your siblings about your parents? Said, man, they just don't get it, do they? Right? Have you ever said those kinds of things to your... Maybe I'm just the only one. But so you have a different kind of relationship because there's not that generational thing. You grew up in the same era. Your peers. So when we look at the sibling relationships in the Bible, what do we find? All right, think about all the siblings in the Bible. So let's just start naming some siblings in the Bible. Somebody name one.
Joseph and his brothers.
All right, Joseph and his brothers. All right, was that a good relationship or a bad relationship?
Bad.
That was pretty bad, wasn't it? All right. Somebody give me another siblings that we know in the Bible.
Cain and Abel.
Cain and Abel. All right, was that a good one or a bad one? Boy. Somebody give me another one. Oh, now you see, you're thinking about trying to find a good one, aren't you? Okay, the point here is that most of the sibling relationships that we have described in the Bible are negative ones. Okay, Cain and Abel, Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, Joseph and his brothers, Rachel and Leah. All of these were negative, weren't they? They all were adversaries. We would call this a sibling rivalry. And I think it's very interesting. In Proverbs chapter 17, verse 17, we're told this. A friend loves at all time, but a brother is born for adversary. Did you ever fight with your siblings? Of course you did. Of course you did. It almost seems like it's a natural extension of being a brother or a sister. And you know, I wonder, in the examples that we mentioned, I wonder how much of that was driven by things like money, possessions, and power. Much different structure then, right? You know, you think about Jacob and Esau. Good example of that, right? We just talked about Jacob and Esau, where Jacob stole the birthright, or at least that's how it's sometimes described. Well, what is that? Well, Jacob got the better blessing. He got more of his father's possessions. So there certainly was a lot of selfishness involved there. Now, is this the kind of relationship that God intends us to have with our siblings? It happens, but I don't think that's what God wants. Let's look at Psalm 133:1.
While we're turning there,
yeah.
It probably reminds us how the family unit was with Noah and his two sons, Shem and Japheth. They all, you don't read any arguments or issues there, and they all made on the ark, and that's a pretty neat story.
Yeah, it's... There certainly are, well, we're going to get to talking about some positive family, some positive sibling relationships, but, you know, I didn't even mention any of the kings, right? The kings killed their siblings, and that was clearly over power. So there's lots, there's probably twice as many examples of sibling rivalries as there is sibling unity, I guess would be the right word to describe it. Let's look at Psalm 133:1. Someone read that for us.
Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity.
All right. So here's our... I think this is what God intends for us to have, the kind of relationship God intends us to have with all of our family, but with our siblings as well. I think probably if we were being realistic that when it says here brethren, I think that just means your people. I think the thing still applies here. Let's think about positive or maybe ideal relationships in the Bible of siblings. Well, Bob mentioned one, that's James and John. I think that's good. Let's think of a couple others. Can you think of other positive sibling relationships?
Moses and Aaron.
Moses and Aaron. That's a good one, right? You think about Moses and Aaron, at least initially, who was older, by the way?
Aaron,
that's right, because it's the time that Moses and Aaron go to Egypt to lead the people out. Moses is 80 and Aaron is 83. And Miriam is older than both of them, too. And you think about Moses and Aaron, right? What do? Together, we have a good relationship, right? Together, go and to Egypt, and they present themselves in front of Pharaoh. And it seems like Moses' weaknesses are strengthened by Aaron's strengths, and vice versa. Because when Moses leaves, Aaron's weaknesses for being a leader, which he really wasn't, he falls prey to those. Now, Moses and Aaron didn't always have a great relationship. Remember, Moses is confronted later on by Aaron and Miriam because Moses was doing all of the leading, and they thought they could lead too. So it wasn't always great, but that's a good example. Another one I had is another set of apostles. And we'll talk a little bit about this one a little bit more. Well, who are the other apostles who were brothers? James and John was the one that Bob mentioned. So who's the other set? Peter and Andrew, right. Let's go to John chapter 1. None of the other Gospels record it this way. The other Gospels just record that Peter and Andrew were called together. And that really isn't what happened. In John chapter 1, someone read for us verses 40 through 42. So this is sort of some of the little snippets of Jesus calling his apostles. So here's the calling of both Andrew and Peter. John 1, 40 through 42.
One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first finds his own brother Simon, said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which is being interpreted to Christ. They brought him to Jesus. When Jesus beheld him, he said, "You are Simon, the son of Jonah. You are called Cephas," which is by interpretation a stone.
All right, so what really happened here, right? It wasn't that they were both hanging out together. I mean, if you just read Matthew and Mark's account, you might get that picture. You might get a picture that here Andrew and Peter are together and Jesus calls them to be his apostles. But that's not really what happened. John tells us, kind of gives us a little bit of information, which of all the things that you can do for your sibling, this is the most important thing, isn't it? Because here, Andrew, who always played second fiddle to Peter. I mean, even in this passage, where Andrew is called first, what happens? Andrew's described as what? Simon Peter's brother. Can you imagine? I mean, doesn't that drive you crazy sometimes? When, you know, maybe it doesn't drive me crazy, but, you know, when you're all the time playing second fiddle to your brother. Well, Andrew apparently was in that situation. Whether it bothered him or not, it didn't bother him so much that he didn't go find his brother. But he's identified as Simon Peter's brother. So Andrew here is called by Jesus. He meets Jesus. And what's the very first thing he does? He goes and gets his brother Peter and says to him, "We have found the Messiah." And you know, it may be that you find yourself in a situation where you find Christ before someone in your family finds Christ. Now, whether it's your brother or anyone else, make sure you do what Andrew does. And that is, go find your family and say, "I found Christ." So, all right, those are a couple of positive examples. There aren't really all that many. So what commandments exist regarding our siblings? Well, to be real honest, I couldn't find much. The only one that I found that seems to apply is in 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4, verses 20 and 21. Now, as we read this, I want to preface it by saying that I think there's some that will argue that this passage is not speaking of a physical brother, but instead is speaking of a spiritual brother, and I wouldn't disagree with that point. I think that the bigger picture here is a command for you and how you ought to interact with your brethren in the church. But I think there probably is something here for us about our physical brethren. So 1 John 4, beginning in verse 20. "If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he does not love his brother for he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also." And so, in a very real sense, the commandment here is to love your brethren. And I think this is probably speaking... if I were just reading this passage in and of itself, I would tell you this is not speaking about your physical brothers. I think this is speaking about your spiritual brothers. But I think the same thing applies too. If you can't love your family, how can you love God? And that was really it. That's all we've got about siblings in the Bible. Some stories about negative sibling relationships, and one story about Andrew going and finding Peter. Any comments about what is expected of siblings?
On that last point, he that loveth not his brother, that loveth is agape love and not filial.
Correct.
So that's why it tends to make us believe that it's talking about the spiritual relationship. But I admit your point, right, too. I think we should, our siblings, we should love them. But maybe not like we love our brothers and sisters.
Yeah, our next big topic, we're gonna have to address that. Yeah. There is most certainly a difference between our relationship with our spiritual family versus our relationship with our physical family. And we got to tackle that next.
I wonder how the dynamics have changed over the centuries between brothers and sisters. I mean, it's not up until the, 50s and 60s or 70s that families started becoming smaller. It used to be that there were lots and lots of siblings that you interacted with, and you didn't have TV, you didn't have all these other activities going on. And so the relationships between brothers and sisters were probably stronger because there were more of them and they were closer together. I wonder, can we take anything away or learn anything from the fact that most families now have one, two, maybe three kids on average at the most? And how has the dynamic changed now?
I think there's probably one other thing that plays into that too. What did families do? You know, it wasn't that long ago that you were part of the family business, right? I mean, a good example is Jesus was a carpenter. Why was Jesus a carpenter? Well, because his dad was a carpenter, you know? And there still are family businesses that exist, but there was a time when you were born into not just a family, but a business. And then you eventually became, you know, not only siblings, but you became business partners. You worked together. So you lived together, then you went and worked together. I mean, you just couldn't get away from your family. There certainly is something there. I think some of our family dynamics would be very foreign to people 50 years ago, that you see your family twice a year, sometimes maybe not at all. I think people would find that strange.
Another aspect, too, is we were more a rural community. You know, I think back of my dad's family. They had lots of brothers and sisters. And you look at the families before them, it was like they had 15 in the family or 10 or, you know, yeah. What I'm saying? And it just gradually kept. But your family members, they had to help. They were like a big asset for crops and getting the food that would sustain you through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But,
that was part of the reason why Joseph was so hated by his brothers. It appears as though Joseph, who was the son, just all of that family is all messed up, right? Here, Jacob has two wives who are sisters. Why would you do that, right? Well, he didn't choose to do that. It was trickery that it was done to him that way. And he loved Rachel, but Leah was the one that gave him children. And so here, Rachel, his favorite wife, bears a son for him, and so that becomes his favorite son. And so what does he do? Well, it appears as though his favorite son doesn't have to go work in the fields like the rest of his sons do. The rest of his sons are out working, and what's Joseph doing? Parading around in a special coat. I mean, just all of that, you know, he didn't have to work like the rest of them had to work. Very interesting.
Dwayne.
And he was younger too, but, I mean, how young was he? He was sold as a slave. I mean, he was old enough to work because he was sold as a slave. So, you know, by the time he gets to Potiphar, he's, you know, I don't know how long he stayed with Potiphar, but long enough to become master of the house. You're not going to put a kid in charge of the entire house. You're not going to, you know, Potiphar's wife isn't going to desire after a child. So he was old enough to work. I get the picture in my mind he was. Dwayne?
Yeah, of course, you know, Bob and I are third cousins. We come from a third clan. And the clan that I came from had the 15 children. And they needed them to work in the field. The only problem was there was two boys and all the rest of them were girls.
I know all about that.
It finally got next to the last was a boy.
Yeah.
The first boy died at childbirth. There's only one boy that really made it.
All right, let's move on to our next topic because we'll need all of our time to talk about this. We may talk a little bit about it next week too. And that is what to do with our family members who are not Christians. I think it's a valuable question, but it's a difficult question. I think it's a very difficult topic for us to discuss, but an even more difficult topic to implement. And I want to first begin by reminding you that if you find yourself in this situation where part of your family or a member of your family has not named Christ, understand that it probably causes you a lot of suffering, but Jesus himself also had unbelieving family. Remember in John chapter 7, verse 5, it just makes it very clear, for even his brothers did not believe in him. Jesus had a few brothers, and his brothers didn't believe in him. So much so that when we go to Mark chapter 3, verse 21, Jesus here is out teaching, and what does his family say of him? They say, you got to be crazy, right? Mark 3:21. But his own people heard about this. But when his own people heard about this, they went out and lay hold of him, for they said he is out of his mind. And so, if you find yourself in a situation where someone in your family doesn't believe, or maybe you're the only person in your family that believes, and no one else in your family believes in Christ, well, understand that Jesus was in the same situation that you were. Now, the difficultness of the situation doesn't really change our obligations. And I think the Bible very clearly lays out for us expectations on how we are to interact with our non-Christian family members. And I think there's really two different situations. The first situation is a family member who has never become a Christian, never named Christ for whatever reason. And I think... In talking about this, I want to say that we're dealing with people who are of an age that they know, right? We're not talking about children. We've discussed how you're supposed to interact with your children before. That's not what we're talking. We're talking about here an adult who has not named Christ. I think there's one way to interact with that person, and then the family member who has fallen away, who has named Christ and forsaken him. I think that's a separate situation. So let's first talk about the family member who has never named Christ. Well, how should you treat them? Well, you should treat them the same as you do any other non-believer. You should speak of God and Christ often with them. You should pray in their presence. You should pray for them, particularly for their soul and for their salvation. You should preach to them through every opportunity, just in the same way as what fathers are commanded to do for their children. You should live a godly life. Be an example to them. And when I say live a godly life, I really mean live a godly life. They're your family, and so they know the intimate details of your life. They're going to be able to know right away if your Christian life is a charade. And if your Christian life is a charade, that may be part of the reason why they never have named Christ. If these are older members of the family who have never had interest in God, it's going to be very difficult. But, and when I say it's going to be very difficult, they've made up their mind to not be a Christian. And in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 2, Paul tells Timothy, preach the word. And then he says what? Preach the word. That's right. Be ready in season and out of season. If you have a family member who is not a Christian and you try to talk to them about the Lord, how does that usually go? Usually it doesn't go so well, does it? That's the out-of-season part, right? It's easy for us to talk about Christ with our family members who have named Christ. It's difficult for those who have not. And so that's the out-of-season. Preach the word out of season. Let's go to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, beginning in verse 54, here is Jesus going home. Okay. He goes home and he started his ministry, but now he's back in his hometown amongst his people, many of whom could have been his family, maybe his close relatives, maybe his distant relatives. But let's read 54 through 57, if someone would read that.
And when he was coming to his own country, he taught them in the synagogue, insomuch that they were astonished and said, "Whence hath this man this wisdom and these mighty works? Is he not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And his brethren, James and Joseph, Simon and Judas, and his sisters, are they not all with us? Whence then hath this man all these things?" And they were offended in him. But Jesus said unto them, "A prophet is not without honor, save in his own country and in his own house."
So here Jesus goes home, and they're like, "Who is this guy? Where did he learn to do all of this? We know him, right? We know his father. We know his mother. We know his siblings. Who is this? And where did he get all of this from?" And then what does it say in verse 57? What does it say?
They were offended.
They were offended. The Bible doesn't use the word offended in the same way you and I use the word offended. You know, I might be offended and really, if I were to use the right word in the Bible, I'd be annoyed. Okay, that's not the way the Bible uses the word offended. Not his immediate family, but the people of his community, they were offended by him. And I think we can expect the same thing when we have non-Christians who in our family who have never named Christ, and we start to talk to them about Christ. Expect to offend them. And be prepared for that. I just want to say that it's going to be difficult. That's really the bottom line. It's difficult. It's going to be difficult for you to preach and teach and be an example to your family members because in a lot of ways they've probably seen you your whole life and they know that that is who you are. And that is what you believe.
You're the carpenter. How can you be a teacher?
Yeah, that's right. You're a carpenter. How can you be a teacher? That's right. That's a good point. The most significant thing about our family members who are not part of the Lord's body and have never named Him is be a meaningful part of their life. Be involved in their life in a meaningful way. Just not in the periphery, but in a meaningful way so that you can have a positive influence to them. And I think it's very similar to the commands that Christians... commands that are given towards Christians who have non-believing spouses. Okay, so here a husband or a wife is converted, and as a result, they're in a situation where they believe in Christ, but their spouse does not. Well, they didn't choose that situation. They chose Christ, and as a result, they found themselves in that situation. I think the same thing can be said of families. If you find yourself that someone in your family has not named Christ, that's not really... that's likely not a situation you created, but it's a situation that you're in. And the commands that God gives to the spouse, I think we can take some and make some application. Remember in 1 Corinthians 7, beginning in verse 12, "But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if a brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him." So the point here is that don't leave your spouse just because they're not a Christian. Okay, don't divorce yourself from your family just because they're not a Christian. Okay, then let's go on with verse 14. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But now they are holy. If the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such a case, but God has called us to peace. And then finally, verse 16, which I think is the key verse here. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? The same thing applies, I think, in families. Here, if you have a spouse who does not believe after your conversion, stay with them because you just don't know what kind of influence you will have on them, and it very well may be that you convert them. And I think the same thing is true of family members who don't believe and never named Christ. Stick it out. Stay with them because how do you know what influence you will have? Remember we said Jesus didn't have believing brothers? Okay, we have no record of how Jesus interacted with his brothers in a positive way. Okay, the interactions that we have are all sort of weird, right? Jesus' family comes to him and says they want to take him away because they think he's crazy, right? Then his family comes to him, they want to talk to him about something, and Jesus says, he didn't have time for them. Basically, he says, the people who believe in me, which we'll read this passage next, the people who believe in me, they're my brothers and sisters. He almost ignores them. But we know Jesus had some kind of meaningful relationship with his brothers, because what do we find out about his brothers in Acts chapter 1? They become Christians. They believe in him eventually. And so I think that's a great testimony to us that if you find yourself in a situation of family members who have never named Christ, stick it out. Be a meaningful part of their family because you never know what kind of influence you'll have on them. And Jesus is a perfect example of that. Any comments about this before we move on? Okay, we are not going to finish this, but let's at least introduce this topic. And that is, what do we do with our family members who have fallen away? And this is where the difficulty lies. This is when it gets really hard. And I don't think there's any denying that this is a difficult situation. Because unlike our family members who have never named Christ, you cannot be a meaningful part of the life of a family member who has fallen away. And I think we'll start by talking about our priorities, and then we'll finish up next week. Because I think the very first thing that we have to do is check our priorities. What is the most important thing in your life? And unfortunately, the saying is true sometimes, and that is that blood runs thicker than water. Right? You have a blood family, and you have a water family, don't you? You have a family of Christians because you have all been buried with Christ in baptism. And unfortunately, sometimes our blood family is more important to us than being a part of the family of God. And the Bible addresses this and just makes it very clear that your physical family is not more important than your service to God or your spiritual family. In Matthew chapter 12, this is that story I was referencing before. Here's Jesus talking with his disciples and his family. His physical family comes to meet up with him. All right? So let's read verses 46 through 50. While he was still speaking to the multitudes, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside, seeking to speak with him. Then one said to him, "Look, your mother and your brothers are standing outside, seeking to speak with you." But he answered and said to the one who told him, "Who is my mother, and who are my brothers?" And he stretched out his hand towards his disciples and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and my mother, and my sister." And so Jesus here makes it clear that being part of the spiritual family is far more important than being part of your physical family. In Luke chapter 14, Jesus has this to say. He says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." And so the idea here is that, comparatively speaking, your service to Christ, your following after Christ, has to be more important to you than everything else. And what does Jesus choose? He chooses the thing that oftentimes is the most important thing in life. Have you ever heard someone say something along the lines of, "Well, when it's all said and done, the only thing that matters is family"? You know, people try to make good at the end of their life because, you know, family is important. I've had people in my family say that. "Well, you know, the most important thing in life is family." Well, no, it's not. And Jesus tells us very explicitly that family is not the most important thing in life. The most important thing in life is our service to God. And so then Jesus goes on in this Luke chapter 14 to describe people who had to count the cost before taking an action. You know, someone who builds something or someone who goes to war. You have to count the cost. And then verse 33 of Luke 14, he says this: "So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." And you know, sadly, lots of Christians become non-Christians because they choose to love their family more than they love God. And we all can think of people who've been in that situation. That someone in their family has been put out of the church because of their own disobedience. And as a result, they become offended and they leave themselves. And so they've sacrificed their own soul for the love of their own family. So the first thing that we have to know is, where is our priorities, right? What is the most important thing in life? Now, you do have obligations, and we'll talk about that next week, as far as what obligations you have to your family members, and it's not all negative. There are some positive things too, and I think it's very clear what you're expected to do. But we'll pick up with that next week. So we'll take a short